Hello and welcome to the Gold, Goats, and Guns podcast for today, Tuesday, October 13th, 2020. My name is Tom Luongo, and we have a lot to talk about. I have with me today one of my favorite guests of all time. She's been on the show a couple times in the past, and she's brought her back again today because she's got an unbelievable series of new articles out, which everybody needs to be aware of, simply put. It's Whitney Webb of Unlimited Hangout and The Last American Vagabond, and Whitney, thank you for doing this today, and I really appreciate it, and I hope you're well. And
be back on, and, you know, I mean, I'm doing as good as one can be, given, you know, all the crazy shenanigans going on, not just in the U.S., but globally, so.
So, before we get fully started, I feel exactly the same way you do. I think I told you before we started recording that my standard answer is that I breathe in and out and repeat when I need to, and I don't expect much more than that on a daily basis. Before we get started with everything else, let everybody know where they can find you now, because I know you've moved from Mint Press News, you've got your own site now. So, let everybody know where they can find all of your stuff before we get started.
Sure. So as far as all of my articles go, it's kind of a mix, but generally you can find most of them at my website, unlimitedhangout.com. There are a few articles that I don't republish there that are exclusive to thelastamericanvagabond.com, where I also write and contribute. So between my author page on there and Unlimited Hangout, you should be able to find all of my things. You can follow my work on Twitter at _WhitneyWebb for what I imagine will only be a few weeks more. But after that, you can also, I have a podcast that's exclusive to rockfin.com, which is sort of like a YouTube alternative, but they also allow you to publish articles. So I have audio versions of my articles, some republications of written articles, and my podcasts are all there. May expand that in the future. If my Twitter gets taken down, we will see. And I also have a Patreon that you can, you know, search for my name on Patreon and I will come up. And so patrons get early access to my Unlimited Hangout articles.
Excellent. Excellent. That's good to know. All right. Well, with that said, you've got a couple of barn burners that I read this morning in preparation for this, because we, just so everybody knows, we like did this one on the fly. I think you contacted me like first thing this morning, actually before I got up. I'm like, oh, cool, let's do this today. So, you know, for me to get caught up what was going on. And you're, the two latest things that you have over at Unlimited Hangout are about what the best way to describe it literally is that it's building the plumbing of a new kind of panopticon.
Yes.
From using AI to monitor sewage treatment plans, literally, and a variety of other things. So let's start there and let everybody know, why is this stuff important from, you know, the standpoint of all of this COVID-19, obvious COVID-19 overreach? Because that's the best way, I think.
Right. So. Well, it's definitely overreach. So basically what's going on is that HHS is now moving to create what it calls the National Wastewater Surveillance Network. Basically what this is, but what they're going to be using it for is very different than the way it was originally advertised. That network was first announced by the CDC and HHS together in August and was supposed to be only about learning about the extent of infections from COVID-19 in communities. But now they are seeking to have a system operational in 42 states in the U.S. by the end of the year, where they will predict COVID-19 outbreaks in communities up to 11 days before symptoms would even start to emerge. And then that will allow them to enable, quote unquote, rapid containment of those at-risk communities. So that's essentially what they're attempting to build under the guise of coronavirus. However, this contract that they're soliciting for was tailor-made to a specific company that was spun out of MIT called BioBot. And BioBot does much more than just test sewage for COVID-19 and predictively analyze that data, right? So, for example, if they get like the tiniest fraction of RNA from COVID-19, or really it's an imitate, what they assume to be COVID-19 because it's never been isolated. It's not based on an isolate of the disease. It's based on what they think is something like the disease. So, you know, that's a separate issue entirely, but then they predictively analyze how that will develop based on a mysterious algorithm exclusive to this company, right? So definitely not a transparent affair, but they also employ or talk about employing the same technology to analyze and predictively analyze illicit drug use by analyzing sewage, also the diets of people so that that can be micromanaged by the state. So, for example, and this is from their documents, right? If they determine that a community or a neighborhood is eating too many sugary foods, then they will recommend to, you know, the authorities that they impose a sugar tax, right? That's an example that they offer.
Right.
So essentially, it's a way to micromanage essentially what you put into your body in a way to surveil not just what's going on in your external environment, but your internal environment by surveilling what you ingest and excrete. Definitely a unprecedented, encroachment by HHS, to say the very least. And I would argue that this is the expansion of a program that they attempted to institute not long after 9/11, something that was part of the Information Awareness Office at DARPA, or the Total Information Awareness Program, that was so controversial it was dismantled just months after it was set up. But they had it had a component called biosurveillance that used quote-unquote non-traditional data sources, including things like sewage, also levels of school absenteeism, truancy and things like that, also the sales of food associated with illnesses, and the sales of over-the-counter medicines and things like that, to determine when a disease outbreak or a bioterror event, because this was in the wake of the anthrax attacks as well, right?
Of course.
When all of this stuff would happen well in advance. So that program, we were led to believe, was shelved permanently because of the public pushback, but it appears that it is making a comeback under the guise of combating coronavirus. But at the same time, in order to have this system set up in 42 states, it requires that these quote-unquote smart sensors and samplers and whatever be installed in the sewage systems of these 42 states, which, of course, is a functionality of the pre-planned Smart City Initiative. And so this is a national push coming from the federal government to create smart city infrastructure on a national scale. And, you know, normally smart cities, they tried to build it in Canada first, Toronto, I believe, Eric Schmidt of Google, in a Sidewalk Labs, Google's smart city subsidiary, attempted to create a smart city above ground in Toronto and got a lot of citizen pushback. So I guess they took lessons learned from that and are now attempting first to institute the below ground infrastructure of a smart city before moving to above ground. That way it's out of sight and out of mind. So very sneaky.
Yeah, no, and I'll be honest with you. Remember that before I did this for a living, I used to be an analytic chemist. I've worked in metals laboratories. I've done metals and soils and food testing, and I've run HPLCs, and I've run GCMSs, and I've run all of this stuff. And I can tell you that, you know, all of the monitoring and all the analytic equipment itself, as well, amazing things. It rife for bad data, bad analysis, bad instrument maintenance, sensor maintenance, and all the rest of this. So, it is nightmarish at a minimum. And I just find I'm not saying that technologically these aren't problems that can't be solved, but in general, this always looks like a, you know, solution in search of a problem as opposed to the other way around, right? So what a shock that in the wake of this coronavirus, which ultimately has to come down as one of the biggest political projects or political snow jobs of all time, not saying that the virus isn't real, not saying that people aren't actually dying from it, not saying that it shouldn't be respected and all the rest of it, but the planned demolition of our old way of life as a response to this, is something we have to take very seriously. And I don't even know at this point whether any of it matters, whether who wins the election. Because one of the things I wanted to bring up on this, when I was reading your articles this morning, all I could think about was, okay, how much do you think Donald Trump has actually been told about any of this? or has he just been given the bullet points? Because he only speaks in CEO speak. He only speaks in bullet points and pictures, right? That's the way he operates. And I'll be honest with you, that's the way an executive should operate, because they don't have time for all these little details. It's not his job to be an investigative journalist. He's supposed to have a staff around him that gives him good information. But as we all know, no one's giving him good information. So even if Trump wins the election and were to find out that this is all horrifyingly, you know, terrible, not saying that I even believe that Trump is capable of processing it at that level, but let's just assume for a second that he would. Do you think he's actually getting that information in the first place?
I honestly have no insight into that, unfortunately. I certainly don't want to absolve Trump, because right. There are things going on related to this coronavirus response that he is an enthusiastic proponent of, perhaps. Yes. Like Operation Warp Speed, that we can get into in a little bit.
Yes,
but,
absolutely.
So, I don't really know how much of it will change regardless of the election outcome. So, for example, Operation Warp Speed, Biden said that he would continue that effort if he wins the election. And obviously Trump set it up, so it would continue under him as well. So, as far as the smart city thing, I don't really know how much he would know about the details. And I'm sure a lot of the nitty gritty details he isn't aware of. But, at the same time, a lot of the people around Trump, I'm sure it's very easy for them to stovepipe info and manipulate it in a way to, get him to promote it or get him to be on board or whatever. I mean, I'm sure that's possible, too. But I also have no illusions about him potentially being complicit in some of these things either. If you just look at his past history before, he became a figure in U.S. politics, I definitely don't have a lot of confidence in the guy. Anyone, in my opinion, that actually makes it to the Oval Office in this day and age, is either blackmailed or bought and paid for. So, it only goes so far.
I operate under that same principle as well, except that in the case of Trump, and I've continued to run my cynical, I have my cynical critic sitting in the background looking at him constantly. The way they are continuing to run this operation against him, that highly cynical read still doesn't pass for me. I have no problem having that discussion about every president going back to Reagan or even Carter to a lesser extent, right? Although I think Carter is probably more of a Trump-like figure in that everybody hated him. Like, you know a man in politics when you know who his enemies are, and everybody hates Trump. And everybody in politics hates Trump. Even the people who are supposedly on his side hate him because he's standing in the way of trillions and trillions of dollars worth of New World Order money for everybody to squeeze out of the lower and middle classes, which they're actively in the process of destroying. And I think the bigger play here, the bigger scenario, is that at his level of understanding, he knows that there's something very rotten going on, and he's not quite sure where to put his finger on it, but he knows that there are very bad forces. And I don't want to go off on my stuff because this is about you, but that are seeking to destroy the United States for very specific reasons that tie into Operation Warp Speed, the vaccines, the transnational superstate, and all the rest of it. And that's where I think that he's a pivotal figure, but he may ultimately, even if you give him the best of intentions, might wind up being an impotent one.
Right. So. Well, I also I don't know if I necessarily agree with you on all of that. I think that a lot of the hatred towards Trump has to do with one thing, that he's an outsider and he doesn't have like the finesse of selling this crap to the public that perhaps Obama had, that these people like to see, because it maintains the illusion of the face of the state that they want to sell to the public. Sure. Trump has sort of ripped that mask off in a way that I think deeply unsettles a lot of those operatives in the Beltway.
That's a fair assessment.
Among other things. And I also think, though, that a lot of the animosity towards Trump is not necessarily at Trump, but at the large base of support, specific policies that they detest have, and Trump represents that to them to a significant degree, whether that's, you know, I would argue it's mostly like nationalist in populist sentiments that really rile them up. And I think that is a big part of it as well. But I mean, a lot of the nationalist populist people that used to surround Trump are, of course, no longer there. For example, Steve Bannon was probably the best known example early on. Mm-hmm. And it appears that he is about to go to prison for fraud or whatever. And at the same time, the person who Bannon described as his top rival for Trump's favor in the White House, Steve Schwartzman of Blackstone Capital donated $3 million to Trump's reelection campaign and increasingly has Trump's ear, so we're told, on matters related to China. Of course, Stephen Schwartzman is a total globalist, very involved in this initiative to build an AI panopticon in conjunction with China, or rather that the U.S. Economic and political elite will join up with China's political and economic elite to create an AI-driven New World Order panopticon, essentially. Right. So that's who Schwartzman is, and that's deeply unsettling.
And I absolutely agree with you on all of those points. And the big question I always come back to is the importance of Europe. And the WEF, the World Economic Forum, the Great Reset, and all of that. All of this fits into that narrative. And the question is, who's on what side, and who's in represents what faction? And I think it's a multifactional power play. I don't think at all that it's monolithic. That the Chinese are working with the WEF to destroy the United States. I think that's one aspect of it. But then you have the Brits, and then you have Trump, and you have a variety of other things. You have a variety of other factions as well. And again, but the big one is the big overriding concern here is I firmly believe Trump wants to stop any potential takeover of the United States by the UN and by extension, the European Union. And I think that that's where his biggest value is. And this is what I've been harping on for weeks on end about. When it comes to this, that's his biggest value proposition for us as Americans, and honestly, as citizens of the world, because that can't happen. If this Great Reset fails, and it fails because of a lack of ability to change the monetary system, which is a little bit off topic of what we want to talk about, but if that fails over the course of the next 4 to 5 years, and it's going to take 4 or 5 years for this to play out, then we will have the election in 2020 and potentially Brexit and a couple of other large things that are sticking in their craw, and the fact that Americans refuse to be disarmed as the sticking points that will stop that from occurring. It doesn't mean they're not going to still try, and they're, as you've talked about, and I want to talk about Operation Warp Speed now to tie into that, because you can see how that helps to build the plumbing of this new world that they're building, regardless of what happens at the election level, because that's
absolutely
what they're trying to do.
I think the election and even Trump in here is really unable to stop what is essentially taking control of the future direction of U.S. policy. And that entity that has already, in my opinion, taken over control of the direction of future U.S. domestic and foreign policy is an organization that essentially represents the interests of the Pentagon, the Silicon Valley oligarchs, and the intelligence community. And you see all of those three groups come together in something that's called the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence, headed by Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, and co-chaired by Deputy Secretary of Defense under Obama, Bob Work, who is now at the Center for New American Security, the think tank that used to be headed by Victoria Nuland. And he was involved in things like setting up Project Maven, for example, that some people may know, which was where Google was going to build lethal AI for the military, where AI will determine who lives and who dies. And even though that plan was shelved, actually the Pentagon is already set to go live with that in 2021. And there has been no media coverage of it at all. They've been testing AI for lethality all year, and they're about to do it. They say they're going to start implementing it in 2021. So a lot of things have been going on behind the scenes. Trump has either been unable or unwilling to stop it. And essentially, Operation Warp Speed is a major power grab by that particular entity. This same entity, the National Security Commission on AI, planned out last year exactly what would be necessary to maintain global military and economic hegemony against China. And all of this has to do with AI at the end of the day. And essentially what they say, we can unpack this a little bit more if you would like.
Sure.
But they essentially argue that American society needs to be remade entirely, essentially into this data-driven smart city panopticon, so that as much data can be harvested as possible, allowing the U.S. to compete in AI with China, because they argue that AI is not just the future of the military, but also just the future of everything that is coming in this new world, in this new normal. And so in order for the U.S. to not only be a global military hegemon, but the market leader in AI, the U.S. must produce superior AI algorithms. And the way to produce, according to them, superior AI algorithms is to acquire more data than China acquires from its citizens. Those algorithms can be trained on, because the way this works is that your AI algorithm ostensibly improves the more based on the amount of data you train it on.
Yes.
Right. So the more data you have, the better your AI is. So they identify, and this is not inaccurate, that China has a larger population from which to harvest that data. They have mega cities that are densely populated to an extent that, you know, does not exist in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And they have a lot of smart city functionality, biometric systems already live in China that the U.S. does not have. So these people had been spending the past 2 years since this was set up figuring out how they can essentially force the U.S. citizens, whether witting or unwittingly, to supply them with more data than is supplied by China. And of course, they can't do this with just the U.S. population alone, which is why I argue we're seeing very similar policies develop in the U.S., the U.K., Australia, New Zealand, and all the Five Eyes countries, that they're essentially going to try and harvest all the data from those countries, centralize it, and use it to train AI based in the U.S. So I think it's all very interrelated, and that's why you see a lot of the contractors at the center of this power play, Palantir, for example, which is very deeply tied to the CIA. Also, teletracking is another one. They are both very intimately involved in this data panopticon that's secretly, not secretly, but covertly, I would argue, because it's not being covered, built by HHS in the U.S., but also they're the same contractors to the same effort being done by the NHS in the U.K., teletracking and Palantir both contracted for similar ends over there, which I think is no coincidence, because those contractors ultimately are acquiring the data from all the countries, and this is what they want to use that data for. And I think it's also no coincidence that Eric Schmidt, who chairs this commission, said, I believe before even the coronavirus crisis hit earlier this year, that the way that they could force greater adoption of AI on the American populace first was specifically in the field of healthcare. And we are seeing a huge push in healthcare specifically for mass and permanent adoption of AI. So I think, honestly, though, as we'll get into warp speed, I think they want to go to a level that even China has not even gone in order to win this hegemony battle. Because, you know, these national security officials, all they care about is maintaining hegemony. That's what, you know, the foreign wars, the CIA coups, it's all about military or economic hegemony at the end of the day. So this is obviously something they are going to do regardless of whether or not Americans approve. They don't care. To them, this is a red line, and it's something they must do, period.
Yep.
So that's keeping in mind.
No, I was going to say, you're absolutely right. And you can see it in every aspect of our foreign policy. It doesn't matter what it is. Like right now, we're trying to engage Russia in a six-front proxy war, for example. We've now just opened up Nagorno-Karabakh on top of Libya, Syria, Belarus, Ukraine, yada, yada, Crimea, yada, 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 right? So it's all a typical thing. Nothing has changed. Policy doesn't change. Presidents change, but policy doesn't, as Putin very astutely put it. And it's something that is deeply ingrained in our entire educational system for new military and intellectual.
Well, sure. But the end result of this new push to maintain hegemony will entirely dissolve all of the public justifications for that, that the U.S. has freedom and China is authoritarian, for example. They are going to eliminate essentially those differences, whether you believe them to be cosmetic or real or whatever. They're going to eliminate them just so we can stay number one, regardless of what that does to us as a country and a society, which is, you know.
And this is where
Alarming.
Yeah, no, it's really highly alarming. And this
but
is where Trump.
Completely undercovered, this issue.
No, I know. And it's this is where Trump's kind of, you know, bonhomie about being, you know, about MAGA and America being the shining house on the hill and the whole 1950s version of America he has in his head is a detriment. Like, some of that is very, very good. Right. It's a very positive message. It's a very good message. But part of that, of course, and you see it in his foreign policy, he's willing to do anything to maintain U.S. advantage in overseas relations, because he sees in his mind, and this is I keep coming back to this, because he's such an important figure at this point in time, that he sees everything that's happened before him as selling out the United States to globalists. Because, you know, while all of this is the criticism of China, the United States, it's all happening in Europe. These people are all unarmed, right? They're going for complete draconian lockdown in every place that they've already instituted complete disarming of the populace. Now we have, you know, we have people who are – we have police – enforcing social distancing rules in funerals because sons can't comfort grieving moms at a dad's funeral. We have pregnant women being beaten in the streets for not wearing a mask in Melbourne. Like, this is the ramping up of this authoritarian mindset that they're going to do.
I would argue this is just the start, though.
I know. No. It's absolutely just the start. It's absolutely just the start. And what I'm going to put into your head now is something that will I think, scare you even more. Because now you start talking about the psychology of this. And it's something that Jordan Peterson used to bring up all the time when he was actually healthy enough to do so, which is to bring up the corruption of the Polish policemen during World War II by the Nazis that turned normal, average, everyday men into heartless killers. And,
right. Well, there's also the Stanford
and that process is here in the form of the mask versus no mask political divide we have now. Mm-hmm. And it's beginning to scare me greatly that we're going to have a willing group of people who are radicalized to the point where they justify, you know, unbelievable violence in the pursuit of enforcing these completely arbitrary public health mandates. And since everybody's scared out of their mind, about not just coronavirus, because they're getting over that, but the potential for what's the next one they throw on us. So what if COVID-19 isn't a bioweapon? What if it was just a natural thing that got weird and got loose and everything happened? And now we know they're all doing, you know, actual bio
development. Yeah.
I'm not saying.
Well, we can actually talk about that a little bit. I had a report on that out before the ones that you read recently preparing for this. But they are essentially, we're seeing all of these narratives go live now. So over the past year or so, back in January, I was probably one of the first, if not the first person, to talk about how U.S. intelligence was Israeli intelligence were essentially planning for chaos in the 2020 election that would end U.S. democracy as we know it and things like that. And here we are now, not that far from the election, and it certainly seems that that was the case, right? And there are a lot of other narratives that have been set up simultaneously with that, including by people like Bill Gates.
Yes.
In April, Bill Gates said that the current pandemic, quote unquote, is pandemic one, and that pandemic two is coming, but that pandemic two will be a bioterror attack. And you have the same people that were involved in the pre-planning that had foreknowledge of the 2001 anthrax attack, which of course was tied to the real anthrax attacker was not Bruce Ivins. It was, in my opinion, originated at Battelle Memorial Institute, which is a contractor for the CIA and the Pentagon that was doing covert anthrax gain of function studies. leading up to that, and also had conflicts of interest in the contract with Emergent BioSolutions, then known as Bioport, that was about to lose its anthrax vaccine contracts due to safety and factory fabrication concerns in September 2001. And of course, that was totally upended conveniently for them by the 2001 anthrax attacks. So right. All of those people, that network that allowed that to happen, including the current HHS Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, Robert Cadillac, very integral to all of that, and now very right. integral in U.S. coronavirus response, warp speed, and other things, are all talking about how there's going to be a bioterror attack in the fall. And it's no coincidence that the war game in June 2001 that predicted the anthrax attacks was called Dark Winter. Then you have this whistleblower, quote unquote whistleblower, as the whistleblowers that get mainstream media attention these days, I would mm-hmm. argue, are not actually whistleblowers. They're often there to either seed things, to create a public narrative. The last one was the head of BARDA that resigned earlier this year, Rick Bright. And he said that this winter will be the darkest winter in modern U.S. history. Coming up here at the end. And I think because the coronavirus narrative, as it's being played out, it is failing. It is unable. It's unsustainable for them to use it to continue to justify these lockdowns and other measures going forward. I think it's very likely a shoe is going to drop. And they have essentially, I really did a deep dive on this on the Last American Vagabond YouTube channel with Ryan Christian a few weeks ago about mm-hmm. going through all the different mainstream media articles, all the different quote unquote experts, the intelligence statements, things like that, the Gates interviews, among other things, that there is going to be a quote unquote bioterror attack that I'm assuming the 2001 anthrax attacks was intended to be until it was revealed that the source was from the U.S. and not from Iraq, as they originally planned to blame it. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, this one, this coming bioterror attack they're saying is imminent. They are going to blame white supremacists for it.
Of course.
And of course, I think it's very interesting that just in the past couple of days, we've seen a surge in this narrative of white supremacists as the domestic terrorists targeting top politicians, allegedly, and things like this. So expect to see a lot more of that in the coming days. But it seems very likely the next shoe to drop is going to be some sort of false flag, whether a PSYOP or the actual release of some sort of pathogen and what they will label as a bioterror network. Because essentially what the war on terror did, right, was justify mass surveillance because we have to stop attacks before they happen. But instead of the battlefield being the homeland, and being, you know, these countries in the Middle East or other countries around the world, now what bioterror would do, the war on bioterror, makes the battlefield your body. And mm-hmm. so it is the would open the door in a way that coronavirus so far has not been able to do, to increasingly invasive surveillance, whether that's through wearables or through injectables. And both of those are currently being researched out by the NIH, by DARPA, and a lot of these institutions under the guise of preventing coronavirus. But of course, if there is some sort of bioterror attack in the coming weeks and months, they will repurpose that to be all about preventing bioterror attacks before they happen, just like the Total Information Awareness Biosurveillance Program. They couldn't get off the ground. They will be able to do that to a huge degree. And so I argue that this, sewer surveillance system is really, setting up that in advance, but they're not going to be able to sell it to the public with the existing narrative, is my point.
Yeah, no, that's all really fascinating. And it makes perfect sense that this is the way they would start to justify it to everybody, because now they've radicalized people. And again, it doesn't matter whether a majority of Americans believe there's all these white supremacists running around wanting to kidnap politicians, which is just rotten nonsense.
There's not, though. It's so insane.
There's like six guys, and every time the FBI busts one of these militia groups, we find out that 65% of the guys in the militia group were FBI undercover agents. Like, it's part of the military.
Stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a solution in search of a problem again, and what a shock that guy Ray, the current head of the FBI, allowed this plot against Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan to come out all of a sudden at right at this opportune moment when Trump is literally, literally destroying every bit of the coronavirus narrative with him beating COVID and all of this stuff and the way he's been leading. If you look at the politics, the way he's played politics over the last 2 weeks, I would argue this has been the most effective 2 weeks of Trump's career as a politician. And they needed to do something to stop the bleeding. And the bleeding here was this idea that white supremacists were going to capture Gretchen Whitmer. And then, of course, they show you the video of the guy that they're saying is the actual guy that, you know, that they indicted. And he's got an anarchy flag behind him and an Antifa flag.
Yeah, like, yeah,
you got to
yeah.
be kidding me, people. Like, this is so dumb. So,
no, but they're saying it's that they're basically the Proud Boys and all of this stuff.
I know. And the Proud Boys are irrelevant in all of this. But they're just going to create this. This is why they won't stop the Fine People hoax. Right. They won't let it go.
Well, that's because this is all about criminalizing, I would argue, it's all about criminalizing militias or the people
absolutely.
That are most likely in the U.S. to resist some sort of takeover, which by and large are, you know, going to be majority white, right-leaning, conservative Americans. So I would argue a lot of it has to do with that. But the narrative they've been seeding about white supremacy all year, this is all done by the same people that lied us into Iraq and said Iraq had WMDs and all this crap, right? They're saying there is that white supremacy has expanded throughout the U.S., but it's also expanded globally. And there's a global network of white supremacists that have to all be dismantled, that it's in the U.S., it's in Europe, it's in all the Five Eyes countries, and that they're working with quote unquote bad state actors, chief among them Iran. And you may think, well, that's weird. Iran doesn't have a biological weapons program. Well, just wait. They couldn't justify the preemptive invasion of Iran with nuclear weapons that Iran doesn't even have. So what they are doing now and what they have been setting up all year is to justify an invasion of Iran by saying that they have a biological weapons thing and that they are helping these quote unquote white supremacists unleash bioterror. And back in June, there were a litany of mainstream media outlets saying that neo-Nazis and white supremacists are the new bioterror threat. I am not joking about this. You can totally find it.
Oh, no, I completely believe you on that. And when we get done with this, I'll make sure that I get some links from you so that I can put them in the show notes for this, because some of the stuff, especially the YouTube from you did about from the Last American Vagabond, I noted that down while you were speaking earlier. I think that's very important. I now want to go watch that. But no, I don't disagree with that at all. It makes perfect sense that they would do this because they know that they're going to push this and there's going to be pushback. They've already done the test marketing in places like Australia, New Zealand, Germany, Italy, Spain, as to what how the populace is going to react to these things. And the latest test bed is the United Kingdom. And so they have to get an idea of what the level of pushback is going to be from people who were disarmed. Now they have to really ratchet up the ratchet up the rhetoric for the people who are still armed here in the United States. You know, and everything that keeps coming back to me over and over again, and this is my next editorial comment on this, which is that this is what comes of giving these people this much money. They don't know what to do with it all. We give them $4 trillion a year to go spend on all of this, you know, literally toxic, narcissistic crap, and none of us want any of this, and none of us honestly need any of it, but this is what comes of collectivism. This is what comes of collectivizing all of our freaking of all of our economic action. It destroys the ability of a society to properly function. And I certainly hope that I'm right. This is the last thing I'm gonna say before we like ship back, which is I hope I'm right that we've reached peak this. That we've reached this kind of peak crazy. And I don't know that we have, but I do know
we haven't.
That I think the crazy is gonna continue. I just don't know that we haven't started to see the turn in the people themselves going, all right, that's enough. Now what am I going to have to do about it? And they haven't quite given up. They haven't quite accepted the fact that they may have to fight their way out of it, metaphorically speaking.
Well, yeah, a lot of people continue to look for political savior. As long as we get the right guy in the Oval office, he will magically solve all of our problems. There's people on the left and the right that continue to be entirely deluded by that. Right. And it's very unfortunate. We are the saviors that we have been waiting for. Stop trying to vote one exactly. into office. It's not going
to
work.
It again tells you that you have to start looking at the forces of decentralization. They wouldn't be fighting this hard. They wouldn't be fighting this hard to maintain control and spending all of this money, which, by the way, Whitney, is as much as, you know, they're spending a lot of money on this because they have to convince us of this. And that propaganda campaign is expensive, and it's getting more and more expensive the higher the stakes go for them. Right. And so eventually the whole thing is kind of like an informational Ponzi scheme. You build one lie on top of another lie on top of another lie on top of another lie. And eventually you run out of people to fool because everybody's like, all right, now what? How do we? And they just look at it and they go, you know, that's all nonsense. And then the whole thing collapses. And what I can hope is that that's where we are. I'm not saying that we have gotten there, but I think that we're beginning to reach the critical mass of people. When it's funny this morning, I didn't know about this. Just to give you an example, like somebody, one of my patrons pinged me on our private Slack server and said, oh, by the way, if you type in Antifa.com, you'll get to JoeBiden.com. It redirects automatically. And I, you know, pinged that over to a friend of mine. He's like, oh, yeah, that's been like that for months. Blame the poltards. And I went, huh. So there's all of this crowdsourced, and you're part of it, and I don't consider myself a part of it. I consider myself an opinion writer on all of this, building on all the work that real investigative journalists do to unmask all this stuff. And it's happening in real time. And most of their narratives can't even pass the sniff test after an hour or a day. And it's going, and the bigger question is going to be, when do we reach the critical mass of people who, when the quote unquote, the normies, I hate to use that term, but it's the truth. When do they finally just wake up to all of this and go, you know what? No.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good question. I think a major problem in one of the reasons we haven't gotten there already is because there is, unfortunately, and I've, you know, this whole time so far, I've declined to really call this out, but I think we're at a point where I kind of have to now. There's a lot of independent media asleep at the frickin' wheel, and they are focusing on major distractions that are obviously there to distract people away from real important stories that are going on, or they have chosen to avoid confronting some of the obvious falsities of the COVID-19 narrative in a desperate attempt to avoid being deplatformed or preserve their audience or not clash with people, choosing careerism over integrity. And that is one of the reasons why we are here, because as particularly the ones with larger platforms, you know, have in independent media and alternative media have become increasingly, you know, just doing the same thing they did 4 years ago. Like things are the same as they were then when they're clearly not, you know, just trying to follow that same business model and push back a little bit, criticize people that are easy to criticize, like Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi, and just like, you know, Rudy Giuliani, you know, people that are just like, you know, career trolls of the state. I mean, you know, there's all this stuff going on behind the scenes, like I'm reporting on and some other people are reporting on. But by and large, I would argue that at this point, a majority of independent media is missing the ball and there's not a lot of time left. So I think what we can do is have people that want this stuff covered while we're still on social media before the deplatforming needs to pressure the hell out of these other independent media people that they are missing so much of what's going on, and they're really doing a disservice at this point to their audiences.
I agree with that. I do it here and there about specific people who I, and I'm not going to get into it today, but I've you can go follow my Twitter feed and see who I yell at.
Who you snipe at? Yeah.
Who I snipe at? I don't snipe at a lot of people, but I snipe at particular people, and you know if you follow my Twitter feed at all, you know exactly whom I'm talking about, who are missing the big picture and missing the thing that while, and this is one of the things, is like we're sitting here, two of us, as critics of American policy and as effectively dissidents for all intents and purposes. And but we're doing that from an absolute love of humanity and what the ideals of the country that birthed us, for lack of a better term, is supposed to espouse. And the highest form of patriotism is being able to criticize your government. And we're rapidly losing that. And,
sure.
And you have to be able, and it's important for us as Americans to criticize our government, but I will not take criticism of our government to the exclusion of other foreign governments from foreigners who happen to speak English. Now, I'm thinking specifically about Australians and UK commentators and whatnot, who all they want to do is, you know, talk about U.S. hegemony and ignore Chinese hegemony or European hegemony or anything else. And because it's all right there out in the open, you know, the people you're talking about today, their analogs exist in China. Their analogs exist in Europe. And they're all talking to each other.
And they all meet together at Bilderberg with people like Eric Schmidt and Peter Thiel that are building it right in the U.S., right?
Right, and, right. And Davos, what I call the Davos crowd.
The great
Klaus Schwab and the great economic and the World Economic Forum and the Great Reset is Sauron, guys. I mean, we're talking about Palantir, right? I'm going to invoke Sauron.
Like, Palantir's the tool that Sauron is using, right?
Exactly.
Peter Thiel was funded by and who he meets with behind closed doors.
And this guy's a libertarian. And on top of everything else, this guy's a libertarian.
Of course.
And I laugh because literally as I was reading your articles this morning, it's funny. As I was reading your articles this morning, as I was getting prepped to sit down and pop up Skype and everything else, the same line kept popping from the movies, kept popping into my head. A Palantir is a very dangerous tool, Saruman. You never know who's watching on the other side. I'm like, they told us they were doing. Like, are you kidding me?
About Thiel being a libertarian.
I know.
Cash cow, Palantir. Yeah, he put some of his money into it, but you know who funded the rest of it? The CIA through Inkytel. And for the first 3 years of that company's existence, Palantir's only client was the CIA. And during that entire time, the CIA was guiding, quote unquote, guiding, probably actually developing their product line. So...
What you're doing in uncovering the plumbing of the New World Order, I get the other plumbing is the monetary system. And it's very obvious in real time how quickly they're getting ready to flip the switch on central bank digital currencies. And that is a story that, you know, that is a story that you don't understand. That's the way they continue to fund the Panopticon, right? The Panopticon itself is a logistics problem. Ultimately, but it's a logistics problem that can only exist if they have a continued money funnel, and because they have to be able to continue to extract wealth in the form of real time out of the general populace, as you know, batteries in the Matrix, in order to fuel it. And the monetary system is the mechanism by which that extraction occurs in order to keep the logistics running. But at some point, if they can't keep the logistics running because, you know, they can't maintain the nuclear power plant to run the data centers out in Utah or wherever it is, you know, the whole thing just collapses. And it's all just a big illusion. Again, like I said earlier, it's just a big informational Ponzi scheme. So very heady stuff this morning, Whitney. The articles this morning for me were real eye openers in terms of how I've always.
How much is going on and no one's covering it?
Absolutely that club. It's crazy what's happening, and it ties into all the work that I've been doing on the monetary system, and so brilliantly well. And I really appreciate you reaching out to me this morning and saying, "Hey, we can do this today," because I'm like, "Cool, let's do this."
Well, right? We had planned to do this last week, but I had to cancel for factors out of my control. So
sure.
That's part of why
of course, and there's no loss here, no rebuke or anything. I'm glad to finally get a chance to chat with you, and I'm always available, you know, always happy to do so whenever your schedule is convenient. Like everything else, life gets in the way, right? Any last thoughts on this?
We haven't talked about Operation Warp Speed, and so
let's do that.
Right.
Sure.
So Operation Warp Speed was originally sold to the public as being this joint, you know, assumably 50-50, you would think, HHS and Department of Defense initiative to produce research and develop and manufacture and distribute 300 million around 300 million doses of coronavirus vaccine to the American populace by January 2021. That is how it was sold. Well, wow. It turns out the day of the debate recently, the first Trump-Biden debate, the organizational chart for Operation Warp Speed was released, and it was not covered at all, of course, because of the whole debate theater that was going on at the time. But what it revealed is that this thing is not being run by HHS. It's being run by the military, and it's being run by people in the military that have no prior experience with vaccines or healthcare production. The people that are in charge of the vaccines, Moncef Salawi and a former DARPA program manager named Matt Hepburn, are both mad scientists of the highest order and crazy transhumanist enthusiasts to a significant degree. And all of this is very alarming because the lack of transparency into Operation Warp Speed, even to senior FDA officials, like the people who lead the FDA, right. Not just talking about the general public, right? People who you would think would be involved in this, because ultimately the vaccine can't be distributed in Operation Warp Speed till it gets an emergency use authorization from the FDA.
Right.
But FDA people barred from even attending and sitting in, not even participating in, sitting in and observing Operation Warp Speed meetings. Mainstream media reporters asked the FDA if they could even explain how Operation Warp Speed is organized. FDA officials said, we cannot even tell you how it is set up. We cannot even tell you when and with what frequency the leaders of Operation Warp Speed are meeting. They have no idea what's going on. This is very alarming. The military is running this operation. And, you know, what we talked about earlier with the whole AI push, this is all very concerning. And so what my article was about in particular is that the contracts, which now total $6 billion, specifically with vaccine companies, they spent more money on distribution and things like that with companies like Emergent BioSolutions, who I mentioned earlier involved in the anthrax attacks.
Right.
So they're the ones producing that are going to be manufacturing this vaccine. They just named a new supervisor in charge of their factory, in charge of quality assurance, post-fill quality assurance. He doesn't have a degree in chemistry or biology or any other sort of hard science. His background is leading military intelligence teams across the globe in Iraq and Afghanistan and targeting North Korea and Iran. He's a analyst that speaks Farsi and Korean, right? So that's the guy they put in charge of overseeing that the vaccines are made to quality by a company like Emergent BioSolutions, who has the most horrendous safety track record, arguably out of any pharmaceutical or life sciences company in the United States. So that should be a red flag for people. It makes absolutely no sense why he would be randomly in charge of this post, despite lacking the credentials and being a career, you know, spook essentially for the military. Right. So, you know, or a war criminal, really doesn't make a lot of sense. And that's just one angle of this. So beyond the distribution ones, you have the contracts with the vaccine company themselves. They are secret. The HHS has no records. They're supposed to be half of Warp Speed. They have no records of what these vaccine contracts are. They don't have them. The Department of Defense declines to comment on if they have them. They were issued not directly between HHS or the DOD and these vaccine companies like is normal. There was no direct government to contractor contracting awards. Instead, it was funneled through a non-government intermediary called ATI. And the only reason you would do that, that's me speculating. But basically, what the end result of them using this method to issue contracts means is that the vaccine companies themselves are immune from freedom, these contracts become immune to public scrutiny because Freedom of Information Act requests don't apply to them. And they also mean that the companies are exempt from a variety of federal safety regulations and other existing oversight that is meant to ensure taxpayer interests are accounted for, among other things, because U.S. taxpayers are ultimately paying these billions of dollars for these vaccines that's being developed for American taxpayers in peacetime. So that's another reason why all of this extreme secrecy is very bizarre, right?
Right.
But this is also alarming when you consider that, you know, these companies that have been given these vaccines have very horrible, I guess you could say, for lack of a better word, safety track records. Johnson & Johnson being one of these companies, they, of course, knew that there was asbestos in their baby powder for decades and continued to sell it to the public. So exempting a company like them from federal safety regulations for a medical countermeasure, a vaccine that every American is supposed to receive, that's definitely a red flag. But even beyond that, you look at the guy who was coordinating the vaccine for Operation Warp Speed, this DARPA guy, Matt Hepburn. He is, I mean, just nuts. The guy, when he was at DARPA, he was program manager for the Profusa implantable chip that is going to be approved, allegedly, the same time Operation Warp Speed is supposed to go live. It's co-funded by Google, and he still manages DARPA's investment in that at Google. And, of course, the civilian head of Operation Warp Speed, Moncef Slaoui, the former GlaxoSmithKline executive, has a company with Google called Galvani Bioelectronics. And Moncef Slaoui is a major proponent, long before he was put in charge of Operation Warp Speed, of bioelectronics, which he defines as these sort of nanobots that can, quote-unquote, hack the nervous system. So a lot of things that Matt Hepburn, the other vaccine guy at Operation Warp Speed, were developing were also this invasive nanotechnology. DARPA is also investigating non-invasive ways to read and write onto the human brain that involves gene editing, a mix of gene editing and nanotechnology and wearables and things like that. So, so these are the people behind Operation Warp Speed operating in the most extreme secrecy we've ever seen in a civilian effort, domestic civilian effort during peacetime. And it is just not being talked about. And it is very alarming. And when you consider what we talked about earlier about AI and the big picture and where these people are going, and the Pentagon already going live on their quote unquote modernization efforts starting 2 weeks or 2 or 3 weeks ago with something called Project Convergence, they are definitely making a push for this. And it seems that there's going to be something going on in the vaccine. We don't know what it is, but it needs to be investigated, and people need to start pressuring, especially Trump supporters and his base need to start pressuring, you know, Trump to come clean about this, because his base does not support this type of stuff at all. You know,
No, they don't.
Yeah. And this is something that's being done under his watch that he's promoting, and that even Pence and Trump both promoted during the debates.
Right.
So, you know,
they're both being fed that, not knowing the specifics, because this is the perfect time to be able to pull something like this off, because it's an election season and their focus is on that. And, you know, I make the point that Pompeo has been running around doing all sorts of damage on the foreign policy front because he's, you know, a dog off his chain. And same thing is happening here. This is the most contested and most consequential and probably the most ineffectual election it'll be the most consequential election since 1860, but it'll ultimately probably be the most irrelevant one because of all the things that we've discussed so far today, because it's happening regardless of who wins. If Biden wins, it'll just accelerate everything. If Trump wins, he'll keep a spanner in the works for a couple more years until they finally get rid of him. That's my read on the situation at this point.
Right. But there's one more element to Operation Warp Speed that came out recently, and I haven't written about it yet in an article, but this is from the official guidance that they have released under mainstream media pressure over the lack of transparency. They published some documents about the guidance. What they say, they don't say how they're going to do it, but they say it's going to be connected to some sort of new IT system they're building. They're saying that everyone that gets this vaccine, because of the rushed length of time for clinical trials for all of these vaccines they're trying to get emergency use authorization for, that everyone that gets it is going to be enrolled essentially in something they call pharmacovigilance, where for 24 months, 2 years after you get the vaccine, they want to monitor how your body reacts to it. And this Profusa chip that Matt Hepburn of Operation Warp Speed and DARPA, that's going to be approved at the same time that he created, it literally does exactly that. That's what it's advertised for.
And that just ties right back into what you were talking about earlier, about wanting to get more information together than the Chinese in a shorter period of time. It all makes sense as that being the dominant narrative, the dominant thinking pattern of the people who have built all this.
There's one more secretive thing too that they're doing. The clinical trials themselves are secret. No one knows how they're being designed, how they're being run, their parameters, anything. All kept entirely secret. This is so not normal for something that is supposed to be an initiative to protect the public, funded by the public in peacetime. There is no reason for this extreme secrecy. There is clearly something up. Why are we trusting people tied to intelligence and military intelligence and these corrupt vaccine companies and, DARPA's mad scientist, giving them a blank check for billions and billions of dollars to spend without any oversight and complete secrecy, even from senior government officials at the CDC and the FDA and all of this stuff? I mean, it's so not normal.
They're running out the clock on us. I'm telling you. Their big changes are coming to the world in 2021. And they're running out the clock at this point. That's what's coming.
Yeah, I think that's what they're trying to do, too. And because a lot of this plays into this election chaos narrative, the more chaos they create after November, between November and January, the greater they can justify a clampdown to, quote unquote, restore order. And they will choose to restore order whoever they see fit. If that's the mass distribution of a mandatory vaccine that becomes mandatory because of the chaos or because of a bioterror false flag or whatever, they're not going to ask your opinion. They don't really care. They're just going to do it citing national security or whatever. And this is what they're setting up.
Yep. And this is why Pelosi's out there this morning saying we need to have a 25th. We need to have Congress and finally put together the commission for advising the vice president on the 25th Amendment, the fitness of the president. This is how this is why she's doing this now. It's not about trying to distract away from the current losses or anything. This is about how they're going to play their game, knowing that they're going to lose the election. Trump will still be in power, but how can we get rid of him when we need to affect the soft coup? Now, here's the big one for you, and this is what I've been. This is my. This will be the last thing to talk about before we go for the day, which is this. Do you really think they're going to pull all this off and maintain political cohesion?
Okay, I think their greatest flaw and their greatest weak point is their arrogance and their assumptions that there are still a lot of people in the United States who are good people, and maybe there are some that don't realize what's going on yet, but when things start to advance even more than they have now, it's possible that we may see a lot more people start to get wise to what's going on. But at the end of the day, I think the people that are planning all of this stuff out are not like, quote unquote, regular Americans or even regular people, really. I mean, they think in a psychopathic, sociopathic way that can't really account for a lot of factors. And what they're hoping and attempting to do is that the vast majority of people remain in a state of fear. My hope and what I think is going to happen is that at some point people are going to break out of that and the goodness, will shine through, if you will. I know that sounds perhaps kind of cheesy, but I think, I think it can happen, and I think it will happen, especially because people don't want their lives destroyed. You know, this bitter partisan acrimonious divisions that they're trying to ratchet up between families or whatever, at some point, that can only go so far, I think.
So that ties into something that came up in the debate the other night. And this is one of the interesting things about it. And I agree with you that we're reaching a breaking point on this. So I didn't watch the entire correctly. The end of the debate, they had a question from a little girl, right? Between Pence and Kamala Harris. And she asked the question I don't like all this, this fighting and this and how are we going to make this better? And this is not, and Mike Pence handled this like a boss. And he said, look, paraphrasing, we fight, but at the end of the day, we're all Americans. And we fight because we're trying to figure out what's the best course of action. But everything's going to be okay, because at the end of the day, we're going to come together and we're going to pull back from the brink. And while it sounds trite and it sounds cheesy, what he's saying is we've got this under control. Now, what he was also selling was all the things that you were selling. But what speaks is that. And I wrote an article the other day called, you know, bringing up the idea of the elephant's vote and the rider's chatter, right? The whole Jonathan Haidt thing about the brain is organized as a big elephant with the rider on top. And optics matter, and that's why debates matter. And that's why these things, as much as they're political theater, that's what speaks. And a lot of people are going to take, whether Mike Pence whether he intended for that message to come across that way, people are going to come away from that saying, yeah, we're not going to let this happen. We're not going to let them tear this country apart. We're not going to let them burn our country to the ground or our communities to the ground. And people are not even thinking in terms of country anymore. They're starting to think in terms of their communities. They're starting to think in terms of their towns and their mm-hmm. and everything else. And I think that because the national political scene is failing, and it's failing, we just haven't we haven't finished going through the Kubler-Ross five stages of grief yet. Right. We're still in, you know, various parts of the political spectrum are in different stages of that. And I think the deplorables or the conservatives or the libertarians, you know, everybody's at a slightly different, you know, part of the curve. Right. But the Democrats or the left are still at the anger stage. And we're much farther along than this. And those are the people that are going to get us down to acceptance. Okay, political solutions, as you said, aren't going to work. Politics got us into this mess. It's not going to get us out. We libertarians have been preaching this for 35 years, right? 40 years now, going back to Reagan. But more and more people are starting to realize it in their guts. They may not be able to express it, but they'll express it at the voting booth. And when nothing changes and they hound Trump out of office, heaven help these people. What's going to happen next? That's my read on it. And I've talked to enough people about this that it just, that's what it feels like to me. And yeah, they'll deplatform us and they'll unperson us and all the rest of it. But, you know, you're not going to stop us because the forces of decentralization are pulling these people apart. So go ahead.
Well, I think the deplatforming and all of that has to do with control over just the flow of information, really, at the end of the day, because they want to create the perception of what's actually going on in the U.S., regardless if that's the case or not. Right. All of the positive things, positive community building things or whatever that have gone on during this period of time, those don't get covered by mainstream media. Nope. Those don't get covered by the platforms that will be around once deplatforming happens. They want to make, you know, ramp up concerns that, oh, this is the terror threat, you know, these white supremacists that, you know, I very few Americans, I feel like, actually know any, have ever met people that even fall in that category. And even leftist websites like Current Affairs have written about how the SPLC and their like hate index, they choose all these groups that maybe have at best like 3 or 5 members in little towns all over the country to sort of give the impression, you know, create the perception. This is really all about perception at the end of the day.
Of course it is. Of course, because that's all they have. It's management perspective politics. They don't have anything else, right?
So the deplatforming is all about managing perception of what's going to be going on in this crucial period between November and January. But like you're pointing out, most people aren't going to, you know, that's not what's really going to be happening on the ground, but they want to create a perception of what is going on. And mm-hmm. people like you and me are threats to that.
Yeah, no, we are. And we have to be. And we have to continue to be brave. That's why I value your work. Even when I don't have time to keep up with all of it, I mean that honestly. I you know, it's like everything else. I have, you know, we all have our search patterns. We all have our habits that we have to deal with. And this is part of the reason why I love having you on the show on a regular basis, because it reminds me. I really need to I need to get back into that mode and think in those terms and get updated and whatnot. And get a good brain dump from you because it's always very valuable. So I really appreciate your time this morning and. Looking forward to what comes next. It, as scary as that is, but it's important that we continue as independent journalists, that we have to be brave the same way that for all of this schmaltz, Trump was brave by saying, this is what we have to do to deal with this coronavirus. We have to live that life. And yeah, there are risks and those risks, they exist. And life is risk, and you can't go through life without taking on some risk, or you can't even
we can't be successful. Become freaking bubble people because we're scared that we might get a, you know, get the sniffles.
Yeah, it's like, are you kidding me?
And that's what they're trying to do to engineer socially anyway. It's all very absurd. But, you know, a lot of people that are new to this type of information, you know, are having all these different reactions. But it's worth pointing out, I think it was Carl Jung that said something along the lines of, you can't make the what is unconscious or hidden, you know, conscious until you bring, you know, light to the darkness or the darkness to light or something like that.
Absolutely.
You know, all the awful things going on, that has to be exposed. That's the first step, because if we don't know what's going on in the darkness, we can't fix anything. Right.
Exactly.
So, you know, that's ultimately what my work is all about, even though it's, you know, I don't necessarily like writing about these things. Personally, I would like to go back to writing my book on the Jeffrey Epstein scandal, but because of what's going on right now, I had to put that on the back burner because, no, there's just so few people in independent media talking about this information, and we're really at a point in time where this stuff has to come out. People have to know.
Yeah, no, you have to follow the story. I found over the 3 years of doing this that I will shift, right, my focus. And sometimes it's on Syria, or whatever, or it's Iraq, or it's the monetary system, or sister, or whatever it happens to be, because you know that that's where the focus is in order to try and understand what the story is right now and what the and what the implications of that story are. And this story is immense. And we all appreciate you taking time out from going after Jeffrey Epstein to illuminate all this for us. I appreciate it very much for your time.
Honestly, that's all historical at this point. What I'm talking about right now, it's happening now. So, you know, there's a window of time in terms of relevance.
You're absolutely right. And I appreciate that. And your instincts on this are completely correct is what I'm trying to tell you.
And
because I felt the same thing. I'm like, I really want to keep talking about this, but I can't anymore. You know, Brexit's not important. This is important. And, you know, I've learned over the years of doing this that I listen to my instincts and I listen to my spidey sense. I listen to my elephant a lot, even though I may have to use, you know, I may have to use the analytic side of my brain to figure out what's going on. I listen to my instincts. And it seems to me like you have that same balance. Indeed. And that's a very good thing.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So with all that, why don't we cut it off here? Because I know you've got other things that you've got going on today. So do I. So why don't everybody give one last, insight as to where your stuff is and how they can follow you and all that. So
sure. So like I said earlier, unlimitedhangout.com is my personal site. TheLastAmericanVagabond.com. A lot of my work is also found there. So between those two sites, you will find it all. If you scroll to the bottom of UnlimitedHangout.com, you will find a way to sign up for my mailing list. That is a great way to keep up to date with my work as it is published. So I would recommend doing that. I also have a channel on rockfin.com where my podcast is posted exclusively, and also audio versions of my articles for people that don't want to read through several pages of dense writing. You can listen to me read it to you instead.
Excellent. I've experimented with doing that and not been terribly successful at it. So I appreciate that. All right. So that's great. And if all the links to your material and your work will be in the show notes to the podcast, and we'll go from that. This will get published in a couple of days, and we'll go from there. Whitney, thank you so much for your time and attention. It was really a joy to talk to you today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this talk with Whitney Webb. I know I did. It was eye-opening, and I'm rarely flabbergasted by things that I read anymore. That's kind of the curse of being as cynical as I am, but what Whitney just dropped on all of us is serious food for thought about what's happening in the world, what's going to happen, regardless of who wins the election in a couple of weeks. And I hope you all take it very seriously. Check out those articles. All this stuff that she talked about today will be linked in the show notes. You can follow my work, as always, at TFL1728 on Twitter. You can follow my blog at tomluongo.me. You can sign up for the Patreon for the Gold, Goats, and Guns newsletter, as well as the market reports and morning daily missives now for patrons as well. You can find that at Patreon.com/Gold, Goats, and Guns. I'll be back next week, hopefully with something equally scintillating. You guys be well. You take care. You have a great, great week. Keep your stick on the ice.